The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
From the metro to Dublin bus to offshore wind farms and housing, why can't we build anything? What is the problem? Is it the planning laws themselves, or is it because everybody is an objector? Well, a new planning act that has not yet taken effect is set to reduce judicial reviews and the ability of people to participate effectively in local planning. I'm joined by Orla Hegarty, architect and assistant professor at UCD, and Carl Dieter, a broker and CEO of onlineapplication.ie, to tell us more. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Now, Carl, you have been talking on this show and on other shows ad nauseum about our housing problem. I don't mean you make me nauseous to listen to you.
Probably do that too.
Quite the contrary. But you say, you confess there during the break, that you haven't really a clue what the solution might be.
No. I mean, I'm good at spotting where some of the problems rest. But in terms of an overall solution, I guess there's so many people thinking about this. There's so many things being tried. There's so many things being proposed. But we haven't actually been able to implement or do any of those things. So I'm at a point where I'm thinking if there was an answer, somebody would have tried it. And it's not just happening here, though. This is a common thing happening in many countries at the same time. What I can do, though, is point to one of the issues. And one of the big issues I would take contention with is the Irish planning system, along with the idea of what's called third-party property rights or anyone's ability to effectively intervene in a planning application.
Does the new Planning Act address that? You know, the idea that if you're down in Tralee, you can't object to something in Clontarf because you've no skin in the game.
I'm going to be straight up and just say I haven't actually read it. It's 800 pages long. I bumped into John Fitzgerald on the way up here today, the economist who is, you know, former head of the ESRI. And we were kind of laughing about that. Like how is an 800-page act? Even to understand that is going to require years to get around.
But, Carl, it's a big, beautiful bill. Now a big, beautiful act.
I don't know. If big is beautiful, then, look, count me out on that one. But, I've gotten to a point where I see the planning system here as having two kind of general offspring. One is supply shortages, which leads to crazy house prices, and the other is increased homelessness. And I think our ability to get through planning in this country is so flawed. And that is one part that you don't see a lot of in other countries. And we need excess supply to rationalize house prices. The international research shows that that's what you get.
I mean,
if we don't do that,
maybe the systems are okay and the idea of whatever's in the act is okay. But the problem is that everything takes a long, 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 long time.
It's very expensive.
I mean, we've had the same discussion about immigration, that the injustice of holding someone here in some sort of accommodation for 4 or 5 years and then telling them you've no right to stay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not fair on them. It's not fair on their families. If they told them in 12 weeks, which is the ambition, by the way, then it is more acceptable. Is the same not true of housing and planning?
This is a rhetorical question. It's like things like justice, immigration and planning should be swift, transparent and fair. Like, no one's ever going to say we love our delayed housing. There's actually, my house is going to be enveloped by a new development. I've spoken about this before, so I won't go over it again. But I will actually be encircled by a new development. That development is 20 years in the making. 20 years. And, you know, it's a shocking delay. 4 or 5 years ago, there was 53,000 houses held up in judicial reviews. As of I think it was in March this year, the Village magazine had statistics showing that there was over 17,000. We've had almost 2,500 homes taken out of the potential to be made because of judicial reviews, because of onboard plan, all that. And these were all actually fully correct applications that made it through planning, and then they die afterwards. So imagine how frustrating that is. Imagine the cost. Even now, like out in Donabate, there's a huge development going on, and the second phase of it, which will provide really important, necessary homes, is being delayed because people are saying, oh, we now want culture centres, we want these other things, these other amenities, and it's somehow that all falls onto the provider of housing to have to supply this. And meanwhile,
but
we've got
That's not an unreasonable demand. I mean, I've seen it in Portugal particularly before a development is built. The roads are in, even the post boxes are in, and the shops are built. So that when the people finally get to live there, the amenities are present. We have done things as about face for too long.
You
end up with a slum. You end up with the what happened to Ballymun, where they had loads of accommodation and no amenity.
Yeah, Ballymun actually won awards back in its day, and it was built with money from when North Strand was bombed. I mean, at the time we were told this is the the pinnacle of
it shows
of
that, planning. That they have the capability to be wrong then, well, as the yeah, capability I mean, to be wrong now.
Officialdom is often wrong, you know, and I don't know what to do. It reminds me when I was working on a farm and a guy said to me, you know, sometimes you want horses and all you have is donkeys. Like, what are you going to do?
Orla. The planning system, the third-party objections, and the sluggishness of the whole system.
I think we need to unpick it a little bit. There's a lot of misinformation about the planning system. If we rewind a little bit and think why we have a planning system, obviously land is finite, construction is very expensive, infrastructure is very expensive for the state. So things have to be done on paper rather than build and retrofit the infrastructure. Sure. We see countries where they don't plan and we see the problems that generates. So everybody would agree it makes sense. We're also part of the European Union. We've signed up to environmental protection regulations and the government has put all of that into the planning system. So
okay,
all
but
of
therefore,
that is
I mean, I've been pushing and pushing it for a rules-based system and you said to me, we have a rules-based system, but the rules are not obeyed. For example, if you've got restrictions on whatever it might be, the height of buildings, the width of roads that need to be put down for the thing to function and so on and so forth. And then they go to the board and things are overturned. And if the board then still don't do their bidding, they go to judicial review and the judges may overturn.
Well, that has been a huge issue in unpicking things in the last few years. If you go back to the Celtic Tiger years, we had 90,000 homes built 1 year under the old system. Planning was certainly not a problem. And if you look at what we have at the moment, we have about 70,000 ready-to-go housing units through our current system, about 40,000 of them in Dublin. So clearly there aren't blockages there. There are blockages
with
resources.
But they're not being built. Why not?
That's a whole different issue to do with land speculation and development and viability and the timing in the market. It's not
because
to do with the
it's also to do with the political system, isn't it? Because if I have permission for a six-story block, and I suspect that if I wait long enough, I'll have permission for a better deal than the one that I got the first time. I mean, surely there should be an obligation on people to build what they have.
Well, that's exactly some of the problem. And we've seen the kind of unpicking of regulations over the last 7 or 8 years where people who had planning permissions that were ready to go and a change gets made whereby there's a deregulation, there's a reduction in standards, there's a removal of the height cap or smaller floor areas or whatever else. And people who have developments ready to go back through the planning system. There's also the issue, you know, sometimes it is third parties, sometimes it's because people feel they were excluded in the early stages, which happened in the strategic housing. And sometimes it's the developers themselves because they've paid a lot for land and they're pushing the limits on what they might get permission for. And sometimes when it is a refusal or it goes into a review, it's for those reasons.
All right. So are you saying that the existing system is, if it were quicker, would be fit for purpose?
I think the existing system in terms of a governance structure for how we make decisions has the key elements of public participation and transparency. However, we now have a new planning act, which we don't really know how it's going to work in the detail.
Because it hasn't been implemented
because
yet.
Because it hasn't been fully implemented, but it hasn't been read by most people yet because of the size of it. And it wasn't debated fully before it was implemented.
Now, I want you both to talk to me a bit about how central government and local authorities should interact. I mean, the local authorities spend a lot of time and they have a lot of consultation in drawing up their county development plans and everyone has an input and they can, then they produce it and it's agreed in at council level. And then you find that the board, for example, doesn't pay any respect to the county development plan. Is it because sometimes that central government's ambitions may be different to the local council's ambitions for its own area?
Well, the government actually made a very significant change at the end of about 2015, where they said the minister can now write rules that are mandatory on the local authorities. So where a development plan had been developed over a number of years, passed by the councillors transparently and democratically, people had their input and they had a working development plan that they had adopted. They were then imposed with regulations from central government that overruled the development process, which meant that the height caps and things like that were removed. And that immediately inflated land values and disrupted the whole system. So sometimes decisions are being made without any risk assessment of the actual implications of these decisions.
This is the law of unintended consequences yet again. So is it that the ministers actually can't cede the power to the local authorities? They don't want to. They always want to have that ace up their sleeve that they can do something to help a developer pal or even their own political ambitions.
Well, we saw back when we had the planning, what we might call the planning corruption years, where that was happening was in local authority rezonings. So land was being rezoned and people were making windfall profits overnight by local authority decisions. But we have a record of that because it was on the record and done transparently in the local authorities. In recent years, what we have is we have things that do make windfall profits happening in central government. So things like lifting the height cap or reducing standards that generate the same windfall profits, but without any knowledge of the origins of some of these decisions and without any thought through to the unintended consequences, which has delayed development, sent thing back through planning.
Carl?
Yeah, I think the idea of cost-benefit analysis, it has to cut both ways. I know, Brendan Kenny, who's the former head of housing policy in Dublin City Council, recently revealed in an industry seminar that by DCC's own metrics, you know, inner city apartment blocks cost about 550,000 per unit. That's cost. And that's the Dublin City Council. That's the government solving this. You know, that's more than double the figures that we quite often hear bounced around. But he said that most of that is due to mandatory climate accessibility standards, climate and accessibility standards introduced since 2018. So we have these at the same time that you say, oh, you know, there's intervention where they change housing caps. We also have this higher and higher set of standards that's, you know, getting more and more difficult to get to.
No, but what would you get rid of in those standards? I mean, accessibility, surely someone who's wheelchair bound has the right to live in a third floor apartment.
Like, can I speak super candid? And I might offend some people in this. Not everybody is has an incapacity or whatever the correct word to describe is.
So I think, would you compare it, say, to taxis? Not all of them are wheelchair accessible.
That's actually a really nice example. Okay. Yeah, and super appropriate. Yeah, I think, you know, you should be able to walk up a few flights of stairs. In fact, most of Dublin was built without the modern planning system in place. Most of it was built before we even had like any kind of proper city planners. All of George and Dublin, they did have planners, but they weren't like they were today. And it's still standing, still works, and, you know, and still inaccessible to a large degree for lots of people. But we need more supply. Like, more supply is a solution to this. And planning blocks supply. Therefore, the planning system creates homelessness.
Okay, but you mentioned accessibility, and maybe that there is some sort of an argument there that, you know, you designate ground floor flats particularly that have to have accessibility.
Absolutely.
That may be some sort of a solution. What about the climate stuff? What are you talking about there? Are you talking about ratings A1 and A2 and B1 and B2?
I know from looking at estimates, and again, some of this was by DCC, that they reckon that some of the climate costs, and like I said, that's Brendan Kenny saying that it's, you know, half of it is accessibility and climate standards. So that's half of the cost, those two things. So, I mean, if you get rid of those two things...
But are they not entitled to try and hit our climate targets by making housing efficient?
If there's a trade-off, by the way, just to say quickly, between climate targets and housing for Irish people or anyone who lives here, actually, I just mean people located here, I know what side of that I'm on. If there's a trade-off between geese from bleeding Canada and Irish children having a roof over their heads, I know what side of that argument I'm on.
Orla.
Okay. To be honest, I think these are very spurious arguments. I mean, I teach construction procurement. I teach construction costs. Department of Housing's own costs say that of their claimed 600,000 to build an apartment, that less than 10% of that is the structure. So, you know, we're talking about shaving tiny fractions of percentages off 10% of the cost already. Right. These are tiny savings. And it's not just about people in wheelchairs using apartments. Decent space standards impact everybody. It's the distance between fitting a cot in a bedroom, not having to move, working from home, having a carer. If there's a gender issue, where do you store the pram? Where do you carry the shopping? Where do you bring the laundry up and down? This isn't just about people who use wheelchairs. It's about everybody. It's about inclusivity. The argument about lifts.
I would ask
we've
you,
had
though,
this before, though. We've had the argument about lifts before. The argument was made to reduce the number of lifts in buildings around 2016, which was done. And what did we get? We got buildings that can't be phased now because they only have a couple of lifts. And now they're not viable because the finance costs are so high. When you only have one block of lifts, you have to build the entire block in one go.
Okay, the question, though, of those standards and how they make apartment living possible. In many cases, they don't. The apartments have no storage. They've no space to swing a cat.
Space is really important.
So, in spite of having all these wonderful standards, we don't have wonderful product.
We don't, no. And I mean, the problem is, I mean, the government have an objective to have denser living, to have more people living in cities, to have people closer to work, less commuting, more sustainable lifestyles. And the key to that, which has been proven in other places, is to have family-sized apartments in the cities. And what we have done is we've deregulated that down, whereas we did have a percentage in Dublin for larger apartments. We've deregulated down to the tiny apartments, and now even a suggestion they're going to go even lower. And what that's about is maximising the rental income per square metre. It's not about building a sustainable
city. But, I mean,
city.
If you say to a developer, listen, we want you to do this, they won't do it. They say, there's not enough money in it for us to do what you say.
Well, that's where, as you mentioned, the stable standards come in. The thing that gets development happening quickly is stable standards. And we've had this change in standards every other
standards
year.
And then hope that someone somewhere pays for it if it goes beyond affordability. There's two things I'd say. One, the SCSI had a cost of new apartment delivery, and they looked at 10,000 units across 49 sites, and they were coming up in excess often of 400,000 per unit. And the Department of Housing's total development cost report, which was just updated in April, said that a two-bedroom urban apartment can cost in excess of 380,000 to deliver once all factors are included. We are talking about massive sums of money. And the issue with planning, to just stick on that, is we give rights to everyone across the country to basically slow it down, stop it, intervene, and it creates years of delay that come at a cost.
Carl, this is where I get back to. The basis for objections should be properly regulated. In other words, you cannot object just because you don't like the colour of the tiles on the roof or whatever.
You shouldn't actually have the right to actually post-planning appeal it. Ireland is almost unique in the world for doing that. We don't realise. We're actually a real outlier.
Are you saying that the local authority, once they make a decision, that should be it?
Yeah, actually, and in other countries like England, the person who wants to object is usually the applicant. You can't after planning is granted. When Orla talks about, how many units did you say have planning already? Was it 40,000, 70,000?
70,000.
70,000, yeah. 20-odd thousand of them are tied up in judicial reviews.
No, how these much are ones that are ready to go.
Well, look, all I'm telling you now, the judicial review figures are taken from the planning granted figures. So I'm not sure that that's correct. But one way or another, when it's in judicial review, again, it's another process holding everything up. We need massive supply.
When there is wrongdoing, and it has been uncovered, as we know, in the board, we won't go into chapter and verse on that, but surely there has to be some other court of appeal when the board is wrongheaded.
The board likely shouldn't exist is what I'm saying. Is that entire process of after a planning is granted, being able to interview is wrong. We need massive supply. Anyone who says otherwise is just part of the built environment conspiracy theorist group. To get supply, Orla, you need to speed it up.
Are you part of that
group? We live in a democracy. People have access to justice. And I would point out that judicial review is not on planning issues. You don't go to judicial review and the cost of it because of a planning issue. You go because there's a process failure, a legal reason why the process wasn't followed correctly. So if you improve the processes and you resource the system better, obviously you take out that.
Now, they're talking about having special courts to deal with these things.
Which is a good
quickly,
idea. Yeah.
Which is why it hasn't been done before. Because the idea that a judicial review starts and it might be 2-3 years before you get a result out of it. I mean, that is crazy.
Yeah, no, a specialist court for construction and environmental matters would be a good idea because then you have judges who are educated in the issues.
The other thing
I'd rather have a specialist court for criminals and just get them seen real quick. Like, this is a ridiculous argument. We're just talking about more bureaucracy and layer upon layer of it.
We're talking about speed.
I'm just talking that whole thing shouldn't exist. We should just let the planners do the planning, and if they grant it, that's that. The idea, by the way, the legal point, that is an industry within itself, which is perpetuated by usually people in the legal profession acting as environmental ambulance chasers who will find one thing wrong with an application, one thing about one bat or one newt or whatever it is, and it undoes the entire thing rather than trying to rectify one issue.
I think you're forgetting that the developers themselves use the appeal system.
But that doesn't disprove my point.
Like a developer gets, permission with
and they bring themselves to onboard Planalla and go into a judicial review.
They have certain conditions that are imposed on them.
And that's the biggest problem. It's not. It's a minority thing that you're only saying as a point to try and disprove the greater fact, which is the fact. And in fact, it actually proves the fact.
Orla.
That shouldn't exist.
Well,
stop trying to delay.
People have rights to access to justice. We have a raft of environmental legislation from Europe that we have signed up to. Those processes have to be done. done. And the tension here is between people with property rights who want unrestricted property rights and the common good, which is that when people develop their property, the rest of us pay for the infrastructure and services and the impact of that development. So, of course, it has to be done openly and transparently. If it's not in an open, transparent process, we will see it in the shadows, we'll see it in the courts. So resourcing the system early on to thrash out these issues early on when developers and their architects and engineers have a chance to make easy interventions and changes through that process early on is the way to do it, not to have the system whereby things are set in stone early and then it escalates.
It works in the rest of the world, though, and they have less housing problems than we do. So yeah. So that's the trade-off. You can either continue down the path we're on and say that somehow we've magically supplied or figured out the best way to do this, and we create a whole fetish of beliefs around it and why it's great. Or you can say, what countries don't do this and therefore don't have issues like this? We need massive supply. And there's loads of people out there, and they're effectively supply deniers, thinking, oh, we can keep on not having supply and solve this. We can't. You look internationally, countries like Tokyo, the OECD, the IMF, they all prove the same thing. More houses, more affordability, lower rents, lower costs. That's the solution.
You can't just pick one issue of a planning system in different jurisdictions and say that's the reason for
you
their housing
can.
Supplier.
No,
it's a very, housing is a complex system. Speculative development is complex. The whole economic context is different. You cannot pick one thing and say that's the reason.
We will leave it there. Orla Hegarty, architect, assistant professor in architecture at UCD. Carl Dieter, CEO of onlineapplication.ie. Thank you both. We'll have...
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.